Thundergrunt.
Bob,
I want you to say your names and your Twitter handles, and if you want, what you do.
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and script consultant, and my Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
I am Arnold Schwarzenegger. No, I don't know. I'm Jamie Nash. At Jamie underscore Nash is my Twitter something Twitter handle.
And I'm Bob Rose, and I'm at Thundergrunt Bob. And today we're going to talk about how we don't care about anything.
Nothing
we're all
matters.
Nihilists. That's all that matters. Nothing matters. No, we're going to talk about Stephen King's Frank Darabont's The Mist.
Yes.
Right.
That's a good way to labor it. I like that.
Right, right. This was a movie that actually we decided on based on a fan-generated poll.
Yes.
Yes. And by the way, fans, please, if fans, like there's more than two of you, hit us up.
They're
talk
sitting
to
at
us.
The tables.
So. Ask us questions. We will bring them up in a future podcast. You have suggestions. We solicit all this stuff. Send them to
writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com.
Yes.
Or you could DM us on Twitter. You could just tweet us.
Yeah.
Or call Jimmy's cell phone at 4-4. No.
Or his address at, yeah, right. Yeah.
Stop by Jimmy's house.
Yeah, we'll have a conversation.
No, seriously. I think the interaction is really fun.
It is really fun.
And the poll was really fun. The poll turned out different than I thought.
Yeah.
We were
shocked.
Dead close. Well, Misery and The Mist were like in a heated race.
Yeah, like one vote different.
Because
there was a hanging Chad on the
Mist. Right, right. Yeah. Which goes with this movie.
It does, kind of.
Yeah. It was The Mist, Stand By Me, Misery,
Creepshow.
That's that was the four choices.
And all of them had a good.
It was about 25% for each of them to the very end, and then at the end it kind of changed.
It was a dead heat.
It's dead heat.
Right. I think Jimmy stuffed the ballot box.
I did.
On The Mist.
We actually had a few friends on Facebook who really tried.
We were like, go vote for this.
Yeah. Fellow Thundergrunner Huey Hessen.
That's right.
He really tried to stuff the
ballot. I think he stuffed the ballot box.
He really, when he kicked it in on Facebook, that's when all the votes started going right to The Mist. So it might be his fault.
This was the one I was rooting for because I think it's the most divisive.
Yes.
And I like talking about divisive stuff.
Well, when Frank Darabont retweeted the survey, I knew.
He voted for Stand By Me.
Yeah.
Right. Is he on Twitter?
I have no idea.
He's okay.
I don't know. Thomas Jane probably is, though. He's the one.
Yeah, we'll get him. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. Jamie.
Yes.
How much did this movie make?
This movie made, it cost at a cost of $18 million. It was kind of a running gun.
Very lean.
Lean.
Yeah. That's so he could keep the ending. Go ahead.
Yeah, keep the ending. And he kind of said that, and you can see all of his movies since he did The Shield, when he directed a few of those episodes.
Yeah.
He started doing this kind of lean and mean approach. He didn't do the old majestic style
but
or whatever.
But he did say he wanted that style for this movie.
Yeah. He did. But then when you look at The Walking Dead, it has a similar television show, of course, but you know, they kind of have similar styles.
This movie does not have the camera work or nuance of Green Mile or Shawshank, right?
Yeah.
But it's fine.
So at $18 million, which is still a lot of money, it wasn't like a Blumhouse 2.5.
Only 18.
Jeez,
come on.
18's a big budget. It made $25 million domestic and another $31 million foreign. So it wasn't
so low from what I thought it would be.
Yeah. It made $57 million total.
Whoa.
Worldwide.
Yeah. Yep.
So it didn't make a ton of money for all the votes it was getting on Twitter.
Yeah.
Nobody saw it.
Well, we are 12 years removed too. Yeah. I think it's kind of gained.
I agree.
It's gained a following since. Right. Yeah, because when it first came out, It was not well. I saw it four times in theaters, and I have never seen a movie where people actually stood up and said "fuck you" to the movie.
Oh my!
That actually happened in a theater. People stood up and were like giving the finger to the theater.
I saw the screen. I saw that at an Inconvenient Truth. No, can you imagine
that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, exactly. But what type of people like that would go see that movie? You know, like, I might like this. Wait, and then they get to the end. Fuck you.
Also, remember when stuff like Inconvenient Truth was wide released in a movie theater?
Right, right.
Yeah, like yeah. That, wow.
Wow. Yeah.
We're going back here. Because we're like bringing up the Bush administration is very relevant.
It is relevant to the time.
To the time.
Right. Yeah.
But this movie is very thematic about that. We'll get into it.
We'll get into it. But, speaking of who wrote it, who directed it, same guy.
Yes. So Sir Frank Darabont.
Knighted. Right.
Knighted.
Yeah. Right.
He wrote this movie. If you don't know Frank, you might know him from his other hits like, I don't know.
Shawshank
Redemption.
Or Green
Green Mile.
Green Mile.
Majestic.
Season one of Walking Dead.
Yes.
He did a bunch of stuff. Wait, Godzilla additional writing uncredited.
Which one?
2014.
Hmm.
Okay.
Interesting.
This is in his IMDb.
What is he known for writing outside of the ones he directed?
Okay.
I mean, I know
The Blob.
The Blob and Dream Warriors. Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah. Dream Warriors.
So here's the thing. He got his start doing a Dollar Baby. He wrote one of these Dollar Babies.
So glad you're bringing this up.
I'll bring up.
Yeah.
Called The Woman in the Room. So he gave Stephen King $1.
Well, so what I learned is no.
He didn't?
That's what encouraged and inspired Stephen King to start that policy. He was the first one to write and ask permission.
I did not know that.
That's awesome.
And then Stephen King was like, after he saw it, he was like, well, this is awesome. I want to do this all the time. So, yeah, that was a nice.
So, and what a Dollar Baby is, Stephen King has a website up there, stephenking.com. If you go to stephenking.com/dollarbabies.php, it's a PHP site, scripted. He actually has a list of screenplays, or screenplays, short stories available that people can option for $1 and adapt. I've done this, by the way, so I can kind of talk you through the process. I haven't actually made the movie, but I did it once. I thought about making a movie, and I never did it.
Can you option it for a dollar and make a feature, or is it only short?
It's only a short.
Well, I'll get to it.
Okay.
So here are just some examples.
It's not as great as it sounds, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's not as great as it sounds.
It's still awesome.
I want to say it's awesome, but then I want to temper it a little bit. So yeah. So here are some of his. I'll just read them off really quick. He's got about 20 of them. I won't read them all. A Very Tight Place. That sounds like one for Jimmy.
I would
My favorite porno.
All That You Love. All That You Loved Will Be Carried Away. Beach World. Big Wheels, A Tale of the Laundry Game, Milkman Number 2, Kane Rose Up, Dedication, The Doctor's Case, Graduation Afternoon, In the Death Room, LT's Theory of Pets, The Last Rung of the Ladder, Lucky Quartet, The Man Who Loved Flowers, The Man Who Would Not Shake Hands, Morning Deliveries, Milkman 1, Mute, Nona, One for the Road, Rainy Season, I am reading them all, The Reach, Stationary Bike, That Feeling You Can Only, anyway, so these are the ones. Here's what I found out when I did this myself. So I optioned at the time. First of all, they come and go, the short stories.
They're changing. Yep, ever changing.
When I optioned it many years ago, I paid my $1 and optioned Survivor Type.
That's the title?
Survivor Type. Survivor Type is now, I noticed, not on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people did Survivor Type around the time I optioned it. Survivor Type's actually being done for the new Creep Show. So they probably took it off.
Mm-hmm.
They probably said, I'm going to take it off. Here's the deal with it. You pay $1, and you can do this through the website. Like, there's a whole, you have to type your name and email address and stuff. I think they send you a contract.
That makes sense.
Click here for PDF sample of the contract. I think they send you one, you send the dollar back. That's the deal. You can't make any money off of it. You can't show it on the internet.
Whoa.
It can only be shown at some festivals.
Only some.
Yes, and he has a list of some festivals. And I can't remember what they are exactly, but they might be like the Stephen King Dollar Baby Festival and things like that. So that's
pretty restrictive.
It's pretty restrictive.
Yeah.
So that is why I eventually, after I went through this process, I said, do I really want to put all this work into it and then only be able to show up for these certain festivals.
And that's if you get in the festival.
If you get in the festival.
Yeah, because Very Tight Place is a great short story and one that I think I would love to adapt into a feature. So when I heard you say that it's on that list, that's why I was like, is it for features too? So that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so you could probably do a feature, but you just can't show it anywhere.
It almost makes me want to option one of them, shoot it on my cell phone in like 1 hour, and then start submitting it to festivals. Well, be like, and then Stephen King's, you know, and then A Very Tight Place. And then
I tell you who it might make sense for. It might make sense for film students.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great,
you know, a great idea for a film student.
Yeah.
It just stinks that you can't put it anywhere.
Yeah, and you know, read the terms and services, decide for yourself, because maybe I'm being more restrictive here.
But I think
I'm
that's great still.
Yeah. Maybe you can get it into Sundance, for
this
example.
This is relevant because this basically was started by Frank Darabont.
Right. He wrote him a letter, asked for permission, and Stephen King then said,
and he created this thing.
I'm going to do this for other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was the first.
That's right. Yeah.
And
that's
his career has been intertwined with King's completely.
Yeah.
So
they're good friends. And,
right. I mean, well,
yeah.
How
could you not be?
Three arguable classics.
Yeah.
And maybe the best Stephen King adapter, arguably. Yeah. Something to be discussed later, not here.
Right.
But yeah. But I'm saying he's like intertwined with King.
Yeah.
Like forever now.
Forever.
Forever. Yeah. Right. So that's why that's relevant. Yeah.
Right. And so also we should mention that The Mist was a short story. It's adapted. Mm-hmm. It's a novella, actually. I think it's like 130 pages or
something like that.
It's somewhere in that vicinity. I originally read it when it was in Skeleton Crew.
And
as
that's
a kid.
Me, same with me.
That was one of the Stephen King paperbacks I owned.
Still own it.
You still own it?
Me too.
I think I got rid of all my paperbacks like in the 90s, or they're in like a box somewhere, and I'm going to open them up and find them all again. But it was one I probably had 7th, 8th grade. It took me, I don't know that I ever read the whole thing. I would skip around.
Yeah.
But The Mist was certainly one of the ones that I read as a kid.
Too.
That was my introduction.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Jamie's introduction, let's talk about Monster in the House.
Ooh.
Monster in the House. We need these little bumpers.
I know.
Monster.
It's time for Monster in the House.
Right, right. What is Monster in the House first?
Yeah. So Monster in the House is a idea that Blake Snyder came up with as one of his
Save the Cat Guy
as one of his genres. So there are a bunch of genres: buddy love, institutionalized, and Monster in the House is the horror genre.
Yeah.
He calls. And the way Save the Cat goes, they're more patterns.
Mm-hmm.
They're less like genres like we think of them, horror comedy, and they're more just like how something plays out, like what's the one I'm thinking of? The Golden Fleece is like usually a quest movie or trying to win a prize.
Right, right.
Monster in a House is it's the following things. It's usually there's a monster, and in this case, I think the monster's obvious.
Yeah.
It's the mist, and the monster's in the mist.
I was going to say Miss Carmody, but go ahead.
Well, we can talk about that
later.
There is some truth to that. And this is where this one gets a little wonky, in my opinion. So there's a monster. There's a house. The house is the grocery store.
Yeah.
Okay. The house is a grocery store. And then there's usually a sin that brings about the monster. Now,
great discussion.
This is an interesting one because I think the sin on the surface is obvious. But if you go with, like, would you say, who's the real monster? Because this is definitely one of those stories like Night of the Living Dead or maybe The Lottery, you know, something like that.
I always call them It's About the People movies.
It's about the people.
Mm-hmm. It's not about the monster doesn't matter.
Kinda,
Jaws is not really about a shark.
It's kind of like Lord of the Flies.
Fight Club's not about fighting.
Right.
Lord of the Flies, but Lovecraft's around it, you know, sort of thing. So, but the sin that brings about the monster is kind of playing with science.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the old Frankenstein
Which
thing.
Is interesting because if you read anything about this movie, is that it originally started with the lab.
Yeah.
Yes.
Originally, that was the opening scene, was the sin. Yeah. We were going to open with sin.
Yeah. It's a real cheeseball scene, too. I read it.
Yeah,
which
me too.
I think it's going to go to our discussion later about what the actual tone of this movie
is.
Because that lab scene.
No, it is.
Lab scene changes the tone of this whole movie.
It does.
Yeah.
Well, I prefer it the way it is.
And Andre Brower was the one who persuaded him to not shoot.
To not shoot.
Good on Andre.
Yeah.
Right. But that's, we would have seen a tangible sin.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here it's discovered later. Right.
Agreed. Yeah. And I think that's why it's messy, because I think the sin of this movie is people thinking they're better than their neighbor. And you could argue that the scientists are trying to be better than everybody else and do something that
you could
no
make
one,
it all encompassing.
You could make
that's what Bruce Carmody was trying
you
to argue.
Could exactly. And you could make that argument, but we don't see that. So it's less tangible.
It's the off-screen movie.
Right, the off-screen movie. So, yeah, the sin is a little messy.
The off-screen movie
when you use the term the messy, because it's there, but it's not concrete. And
the off-screen movie here is like a Roger Corman movie. I love it.
Yeah.
For how heavy and serious this movie can get, it's like the cheesiest off-screen movie
it's true.
Possible.
Yeah.
It the book kind of had elements of that.
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
Frankenstein and werewolf and stuff, and it was kind of cheesy, but it had this other dark side to it.
I think Stephen King himself is a lot cheesier than most people give him credit
for. I agree.
And he is fine with it.
Yeah.
Stephen King's tastes and his intention are way cheesier than most people ever assume.
I think you're right.
Yeah. I know I'm right. I've reading all of his movie reviews, the movies he loves angered people. He loves like schlock.
Yeah. Deep Blue Sea.
Deep Blue Sea. He loved the remake of Death Race so much. Like people were angry at him. Like the Jason Statham one. And they were like, how could you like this? He's like, it was awesome. Like, that's Stephen King, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. You got to know the source a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I had planned to talk about theme later when you were going into nihilism, but I wonder if it's better to bring it up. When you're going in, you want to talk about the moral premise later.
No, well, it doesn't matter. We could talk about that now. The only one thing I wanted to say on the monster in the house, the other thing I wasn't sure if there was a half man in the story.
Can you give us what a half man is?
So
for people?
Oftentimes, and this isn't a requirement of a monster in the house, but oftentimes in monster in the house, there's a half man, which is somebody who's faced the beast in some way before, faced the evil in some ways before, lived to tell about it, and now it's kind of a mentor figure. Quint might be an example.
Quint
in Jaws.
Quint is
the
absolute half man.
That's where the term came from.
Yeah.
You see it all the time.
But I don't
think this one has
even the army guys aren't the half man.
Right.
The
guy who runs in the beginning, I think his name is Dan, who with the blood, he's covered with blood, and he's like, there's something in the mist, but he doesn't end up being.
Yeah, that's not it.
Yeah.
I was almost thinking it could be something. From what we're talking about, like let's say one of the army guys was in Afghanistan and he saw evil and the way people turned on each other.
That's not there.
So it's missing that ingredient, or even
one of the army guys that would have survived the lab explosion.
Yeah, everyone.
And, like, he dealt with them for half a day.
Yeah.
And now he's like, you don't understand what's coming. I've seen it, but that doesn't happen. That's
and that
not here.
Sort of, I think, enhances the unknown.
Right. Yeah.
The unknown aspect, the ambiguity about
the
what
Lovecraftian
the
element in the movie, right?
The lack of knowledge, right?
Right,
enhances that Lovecraftian aspect.
Because if somebody known, it would be too
they
much
could
exposition.
Just sit there and explain it all, and then it would be I was waiting for the praise of the killer speech. And it was like, which is where
I was going
to
say,
I'm trying to help the audience listen.
Thank you, Bob, for reminding
me. Half Man and Praise of the Killer, the more I think about it, they kind of do have similarities.
Dr. Loomis.
Yeah.
You know?
What is Praise of the Killer?
So often you'll find, and it doesn't have to just be in horror movies, but in horror movies, definitely it works well, is someone who the audience considers as powerful and wise or respected, gives
a
speech, just knowledgeable in general, gives a speech about how dangerous the threat is that they're going to face. And Quint, you know,
he's quintessential.
Quint, I mean, that the USS, what is it? The
Indianapolis
is one long praise of this killer speech.
Right.
It strikes fear into your heart about the villain, and it like sort of enhances your feeling that all the characters are in danger. And we've tracked this as we started talking about this through many movies. We even saw it in Men in Black, you know, Tommy Lee Jones' character is talking about the roach monster.
Usually it's like the world-weary guy,
the famous ones,
character who has seen everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. The half man, right? Like you said, Jamie, like the most famous ones are Loomis talking about Michael Myers. Like, I spent 30 years trying, I spent this many years trying to reach him and this many years trying to make sure he never got out. And Kyle Reese with the Terminator, like, he will not stop until you're dead. Right. This movie doesn't have that.
It intentionally lacks that. I think that is a decision.
Yeah, creative choice.
Because the audience, he wanted the audience to be a part in this story.
We're learning when they learn.
It's part of the whole theme. We're them.
We're them.
We can't know more than they.
Yeah.
It's like, that'd be wrong.
Yeah, and it works well, but you're right. Then it doesn't really
That's the reason that the lab that would be wrong.
Exactly.
That's the reason it would be wrong.
And it fits that standard recipe. It doesn't fit that standard recipe of the.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if in Lovecraftian stories how often it happens.
If that shows up.
Yeah, because a lot of
there's usually the ones I've read, I don't feel like there's a lot.
Dude, I've read so many. I'm like
But I don't feel like the half man is a thing.
No.
Usually it's someone encountering evil for the first time and being completely
not understanding
by
what it is.
Right, because that was the point of Lovecraftian.
And like, the cosmic horror makes you go crazy. Right.
We can't understand it. We can't understand what it is. We're nothing.
Right. Right. And that's definitely an aspect of this movie. What is the mist?
Yeah.
Now, with that said, though, how's it? How do you guys feel it's handled when it's like, what is the mist? Well, it's a bunch of bugs.
Well, it's everything. Yeah. There's lots of...
But you know what I mean? Like, in the end, though, like, you understand what it is.
We do. Pretty clearly.
The Lovecraftian stuff washes away in the halfway point.
I think there is a version of this movie where we never know what's in the mist. It just people die.
They never see it.
Right. That's what I was trying to say.
Could be the Russians. It could be I can see that version of the movie working.
I think that version of the movie is the monster movie without the commentary that Frank Darabont was trying to push into the movie. Like, he wanted to make a movie about humans, so it didn't actually matter that the mist was so well defined by the end. Oh, it's another dimension. A bunch of bugs from another dimension are killing people. Okay.
You're right. They do give us enough information between the various things that we absorb.
It's not that weird in the end.
It's not that weird.
They're just a bunch of animals from another dimension.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
And the mist is their atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's not like...
Yeah.
It's not Lovecraftian at the end. It's like, okay, well, they're just...
Which, I don't know if the... I haven't read the short in so long. I wonder if the short is that concrete.
The short is definitely just super quick. Like, some of the differences in the short is definitely more ambiguous. But I think the short does have creatures and things like that.
Yeah, it does.
Giants.
Right. Exactly. So it's more ambiguous, but it still has stuff, you know? So that's one change. The other, just since we're on the case... The other is the end, which we'll talk about extensively later.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Marcia Gay Harden's character, what's her name again?
Miss Carmody.
Miss
Carmody. Her character is less fire and brimstone and more folksy and a little less heightened probably as she is. It's still heightened. I mean, it's still Stephen King heightened.
I think that was Frank Darabont's true addition to the movie, besides the ending.
Yeah, he said he went into on the... I listened to the commentary, and the only reason it's so fresh is I literally listened to it right before I left for here. he said that he added two Mrs. Carmody beats specifically, and that was her alone in the bathroom begging God to give her the strength to lead these people, to show that, number one, she is like a normal person who just is afraid in the situation. He said the book she was very cartoonish and didn't have any sort of like tangible human characteristics.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and this was his way of showing like she's vulnerable and she's real and she believes that like what she's doing is for the greater good. And that's like that scene. She's like, help me, help save them.
Right.
And then the second scene is the sacrifice, Jessup's sacrifice, the soldier.
Expiation.
That's not in the short story. So he said all of the warnings.
Which is crazy because that's the best inciting moment for them to leave.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you need it.
You need it. Like,
so it's very instructive, right?
Because otherwise you could still be compromised.
Otherwise they wouldn't have left and they would have been fine.
It's the escalation of it all, of the theme, of the... And he said, the only thing that he thought that besides the ending that the story was missing was sort of the Mrs. Carmody mob coming to a head and showing the result of all that paranoia and fear. And so he created that sacrifice scene just so it could grow like the Mrs. Carmody character. So,
and I mean, let's talk. Can we talk about Mrs. Carmody for a second?
Yeah.
Just in general, like, I mean, what we were talking about before we started recording was this was written during the Bush era. And that was a very, I mean, we're not going to talk about this era.
This era.
Because we just don't, that's not the podcast wrong. But as far as writing is.
I think sometimes people forget how bad the Bush era was.
Yeah.
Well, the sequel's way worse. We're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about that. But Frank Darabont was not happy with the Bush administration. And I think obviously the script maybe was more reactive than maybe anything released during that time. And I think some people hate this movie just based on that alone. Because the commentary isn't exactly, if you were for Bush and that ilk, this movie's not kind to you.
Yeah.
It's not kind to you.
Yeah.
It's at all. And Miss Carmody is like the perfect example. She's not treated very kindly by
the
movie.
End. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to say, like, she's actually, I don't think I've ever cheered at a Stephen King villain dying, or maybe any movie villain dying, as much as I have at this. So
yeah,
I guess
relief.
That's where I lay. I lay as a human, and it tells me a lot about myself.
Yeah.
Like when she gets shot in the head,
yeah,
I am so satisfied.
It feels it's like beyond. A relief. Yeah.
Right. So I,
stoking the mob.
No movie I think has ever worked me up that much against a villain. Than, you know, Mrs. Crazy Soccer Mom.
Well, she's at the, you know, when it comes down to it, in the very end, she's asking for the boy. Like,
her last line
is like, "We want the boy."
Right, she deserves
you
it.
You know, like, and that's
but
where,
like,
that allows that.
Jimmy, I'm saying I'm a bad enough person where that's not the only reason I'm relishing her death. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
We were discussing, because I was saying that.
I'm being honest here. Yeah. Like, I hate her for different reasons.
One of the reasons I remember when I first saw this movie, there were certain things that took me out of it. And one of the things was her.
Yeah, right.
And it was largely because she was so vile. I had a hard time being seduced by her. Like, the ordinary people in the grocery store were seduced. I just didn't think she was nuanced enough. She felt like a cartoon character to me.
You're also, mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying, but you're also a very smart human being.
I have,
and you're not very reactive.
Yeah,
you know.
But
well, I'm serious.
Yeah,
I don't feel like
I get what you're saying.
And Jamie was in that grocery store. You'd be one of the people who were really calm and collected.
Well, that may be true, but I understand that people can be whipped up into a frenzy by false, but I didn't really buy her narrative for doing it. It felt like the cartoonish were judging her version. Like, we in the audience
like
are immediately
saying,
oh, what you're saying.
I'm agreeing, and I like hating her.
Right.
Because I want her, I like that character existing and saying a big middle finger to those people she's representing.
So to me, it takes me out of the
reality
of it.
I get it. No, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I come down. And I love Marcia Gay Harden. I think she's awesome. And I think she's awesome in this role.
Yeah. And she almost didn't do it because it was a horror movie, and she's never done a horror movie.
Yeah.
But William Sadler convinced her that it's a character piece.
Yeah.
And that's why she did it.
And there's a similar beat. My only other beat that I have a similar problem with in the movie is when Andre Brower, when he kind of goes crazy, like, everybody's trying to trick me and this and that. And from your perspective, you can see that this is a writer with an agenda, and he is judging these people.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, Frank Darabont is absolutely in this movie more than he's ever been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to me, it just takes me out because it doesn't buy into my reality sometimes when I watch it.
Yeah.
But that's me, and he's different, and I'm different than him.
So, yeah, what I said before when we were talking is that it's interesting to note that Frank Darabont originally saw himself as, like, trying to be a John Carpenter type of filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Which he kind of didn't get to do
no.
until this movie. And this movie, like I said, is, I think it's like his They Live.
It's blunt, you said.
It's blunt without question. There is an agenda,
mm-hmm.
and it is a middle finger to a certain group of people.
Yeah, wait till you hear the chapters in the script there. Like,
right, right.
What he calls them.
And I don't disagree with Jamie. Like,
yeah.
It's so apparent that it's going to take people out of it.
So
you got to be on board or not.
Watching it,
I got the feel. So I'm sort of in between you guys.
Yeah,
and that I love when this happens, because I do think it feels like the writer's choice and not the character's choice, both mm-hmm. for the Andre Brower's mm-hmm. character and all the people rising
Which
up and joining
I agree
the
with.
Mob.
Mm-hmm. I'm agreeing
and
with it.
From an instructive standpoint, that's kind of shitty. You know, mm-hmm. that's kind of the easy way. Like, the story doesn't do enough to prove that the mob would join her, and that Andre Brower would be like, we get the essence of the backstory that there's something, some wrong that happened to Andre Brower by the people in the town from him being an outsider. That's like a great thematic scene where he's talking about.
That is placed in there.
It's hinted, but we get so little time with it that we're not able to.
He seems reasonable up to that point.
Right.
That's the
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. So,
like,
interesting note is that when he's yelling at William Sadler and he adds that slight pause where he's like, I could tell you hate out of towners.
That's
not in the script, apparently.
Yeah.
Andre Brower added that so that would be the note of racism.
It's great.
It's amazing.
It's so honest.
I just love that that's not in the script that Andre Brower added that pause.
It's awesome.
Beautiful.
But I agree with you, Jamie, that it feels like the writer's choice and not the character's choice.
Here's the thing.
And I agree with that, too. I just want that movie.
I think this is where the difference is in our opinion. I think we all agree on these facts.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't say facts because it makes it sound like we've decided.
These are the facts.
We all agree on these opinions.
Well, everything we say is a fact, Jamie. Yeah, obviously.
We agree on these
shit,
elements.
Man, that's speaking to the villains there.
But it doesn't mean you can't write a movie with Darth Vader that we instantly hate Darth Vader.
Yeah.
You know, a parable or something about the crazy cult leader or something that we don't necessarily get seduced by and we don't understand why. However, this is the difference, I think. I think you get that. You're like, oh, well, this is like a black and white parable. This is his version of the world and metaphor.
So they live, yeah.
And, and me, I'm not sure. To me, the movie felt more like, and it's a little tonal thing, like, you're on board with that tone.
Yeah.
So you might be getting his vibe better. And me, I'm feeling him wrestling with something that feels more realistic. Like, what would I do in this situation?
Absolutely.
Where am I going to be?
Yep.
Which is, that could be this movie.
A little bit.
But that's
bit.
Not what this movie is,
and
really.
I am more on Jamie's side with what I absorb from it
what
is
I
what
absorb
Jamie's
right.
absorbing,
right.
whether it was the intent or not.
No, I get it. Yeah. I get it. I mean... It's a movie written by a very talented man who is extremely mad.
Yeah.
And I well dig said. That because to me, this is his most auteurist movie. Mm. I love auteurs because they step out of that box.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not just it's not a monster movie, really.
Yeah, no.
I like that about it.
Yeah.
But I get why people hate that about it. You know?
I can't necessarily debate it because it's. You know, I'm assuming one intent that it's missing the mark with me, but if maybe I'm assuming the wrong intent. So that's the spot.
It's
where
a divisive movie, man.
Yeah.
There's a lot at play here.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there is a lot at play in this movie.
Yeah.
And like, to some degree, the thing that you want out of it, it is kind of in there.
It's almost there.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Because the movie is kind of about who are you in this situation, but it's got an agenda too. So it's like,
And honestly,
I think you're putting it well, though.
Honestly, I don't. It's not like I hate the movie for those
Which
reasons.
Group would you join?
I think it. Yeah,
it asks you that question.
Yeah.
It definitely does because you've got Miss Carmody people, then you've got the willfully ignorant smart people who are like, of course, magic can't exist.
Right.
Yes.
And then you've got the practical people, the Tom Janes.
Yep.
Yes.
Which group do you join?
Yeah.
Yep.
And
that's what it asks you, right?
And I wish the choice was just slightly harder.
Yeah,
that's what
really because I think that's a pretty easy like choice
no, but
of those three
I
groups.
Think I are you are.
I think he's judging two of the groups and putting us obviously on the side of Thomas Jane.
It's an easy
absolutely.
Choice.
Absolutely,
yeah, that's
it's,
the part.
It's,
yeah,
it's
I wish he made us like struggle.
Easy
no,
choice.
I don't want that.
Yeah,
yeah. So we want different stuff.
And that,
I, yeah,
and that's you know that's an instructive thing right there. Like it, I do think it would be. Let me. Clarify. I think this movie is amazing. Mm-hmm. I think I'm shocked it's not hailed as like a horror classic. I love it. And,
I think
and
it's
I,
got some big fans by now.
I think it's got some big fans, but it doesn't get hailed
it's
up
not
there.
The thing.
It's not the thing. And I think
even though the thing poster's in it.
Yeah.
Right.
But
yeah.
If it was an impossible choice with who you would side with, it would be more compelling.
No. I completely agree though with that take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the Tom Jane's people are the only ones
that make sense
who get any sympathy. You know, like and it, even Toby Jones, he murders Miss Carmody. And even then you're like, the movie's on his side, even though he dies. He pays for his sin. Toby Jones is the small guy.
Who became Truman Capote.
Right. But like, you know, the movie treats Andre Bauer's people as you're idiots. You're smart, but you're stupid.
Right.
That's...
And Miss Carmody obviously treats them like psychopaths that are...
Exactly. Yeah.
They all deserve to be killed. Right? I mean,
no,
I completely agree, and that's the movie I want.
Can I jump a little bit to the
go
theme
it.
And moral premise?
Yeah, let's
absolutely.
Go. Let's go
because,
there.
Absolutely.
Because you brought up a point.
Yeah.
But then, and even I remember Frank Darabont said this. Marcia Gay Harden's character is actually right.
He says that in the commentary.
Which
that's
bizarre.
A fan theory too that I read last night.
So he actually said out loud, so it makes it easy for us.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is the theme of the movie. He said the theme of the movie is the monsters you're stuck inside the market with are worse than the monsters that are outside the market. Your friends and neighbors, the people you thought you could trust, are now going batshit crazy because they're being driven by fear and turning into a mindless mob. And he said, I'm going to jump back and go on the promise first, mm-hmm. and because they tie in together. Okay?
Can I say one thing before you get there?
Yeah.
I remember him specifically saying about Miss Carmody.
Yeah, I'm gonna get to it. Oh, that's why I want to talk about the promise because the promise defines it all.
Right,
and
right,
I wasn't thinking of that at all, but listening to his commentary made me feel like we should talk about it.
So
the promise that he makes to his son, originally it appeared at the midpoint, and it was shot even when they were shooting all the midpoint stuff.
Yeah,
and then he realized that it didn't support the theme. If he put it there, that it had to be placed after they killed Jessup, after they sacrificed Jessup.
Right, right.
Because then when he says, promise me you won't let the monsters get me ever, no matter what, he could actually and may actually be talking about the people inside the grocery store.
We don't know who the kid is referring to.
And he did that intentionally.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
And... and also he did it so it could be so the audience wouldn't need a second reminder of the promise, because he felt like once they were editing it that it had been so long since the promise had been made that it would be forgotten and that the ending would be less powerful. And that was like, that's really instructive. Like, it's sort of like you need to remind audience of the goals and the objectives.
Interestingly enough, it fits right in the Dark Knight of the Soul territory.
Exactly. It's exactly
75%. Well, Jessup getting killed is pretty, that's where the hopelessness is.
Right. All is
but I was right. like, when he said that, I was like, dude, that makes total sense.
Yeah,
so then he said, going into the Mrs. Carmody, I'm just using his words.
No,
I came up. He said, the ending expresses the theme when he puts it after the Jessup sacrifice, because he says, promise you won't let the monsters get me ever, no matter what. And the theme is that the monsters inside, your friends and neighbors, the people you trust, are worse than the outside. So he deliberately, in the moments before he dies, Billy witnesses his father killing everyone in the car. Therefore, he's a monster. And
well,
then
Billy
the
dies
monster,
first.
No, he dies last.
Oh, I always.
No, the kid dies last.
Oh,
because I think there's some sound, right?
He kills I mean, this is, he definitely does. The Billy sees his father killing every single person in the car first, and he's a monster. He becomes that monster, and it supports.
Frank
the theme.
Darabont said that.
Frank Darabont said he did that on purpose because then it expresses.
I
the
never
theme
read it like that. Okay,
that expresses the theme because his dad is now a monster. That ends up killing him, and thus like failing to live up to his promise.
Yeah, I never read
that. That fits the nihilism.
Well, actually, that's I don't really want to talk about the end just yet.
Right,
but so, I never read that. That scene to me was always he shot the kid first.
No,
because I would think the kid would make noise. Wouldn't he? I would think he would scream or something.
He said, I mean, he said he watches his.
I don't
he,
like that.
He said, I mean, you don't like what the director said.
No,
he did.
Because I think that kid would have. I think that kid would have made an audible noise.
Yeah,
I think that I can't believe that.
For some reason, I think there was. I wish I had it queued up here, but I think the kid does say something.
No, like he doesn't. I just watched it.
Yeah,
he doesn't.
I could have sworn there was.
So anyway,
he looks up at his dad, and then outside shot of the car, bam, 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 bam.
It was all in the service of expressing the theme. He deliberately did all those things.
I get it.
Creative choices, and then it goes with the Mrs. Carmody thing. He said, God, she says, God demands blood. He'll come for you. The bill is due and it must be paid. And he feels that that action of like killing his son is like
so just because the order is that doesn't necessarily negate the theme. Like,
I know.
Either way,
I'm not saying that. It was more I'm saying the actual execution doesn't read like that to me.
All this stuff when he said it, I had never thought about it.
So, okay. The thing that the one interview I love with Frank Darabont about the miss is where he goes, he's like, I'm obviously not, he admits that he's like not on Miss Carmody's side, which Jamie's mm-hmm. has a problem yeah. with. Mm-hmm. But he's like, see, but the bitch of it, just like in real life, is that she keeps seemingly being right.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, and in the end, I love this fan theory that Miss Carmody was completely right and was actually communicating with God, because they kill Jessup. And then the boy gets killed. The two people that she demands expiation mm-hmm. of, and that's when the mist ends. Clears.
Yeah. Yep.
So was she actually right? Because just like the bug didn't yeah. sting her. We don't know why.
Yeah.
A lot of people just say because she wasn't moving. She actually wasn't like instigating the bug to sting her.
Right.
Was it God? But what she said was, if we kill them and kill them, then the mist will end.
The
and
it totally makes did. It darker.
It totally,
yeah.
it does. Yeah. It serves her. Yeah. There is a movie where Miss Carmody is actually the yeah. hero talking to God. She just happens to get murdered by Toby Jones. So
he poses it as a question.
Right.
He said, maybe she was right all along.
And she was Randall Flagg.
Yes, right. She is. Yeah, exactly.
Right,
yeah.
right.
But
well, so with that aspect, that like kind of helps you a little bit, I think, doesn't it? From what you were talking about earlier. Well, I'm like, you know, there is some hope there that the movie could give Miss Carmody, like, even after her death, like maybe she was right.
Well,
do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's not so much that.
Okay,
I don't know. Even if Jesus came here, I don't know that I'd necessarily believe him if he didn't have the right words.
Right.
Right.
So, anyway, it's the. That's a whole nother problem. But it's I don't know that I get what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
doesn't necessarily solve it for
it's
me.
It's still, I think, I mean, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but it's that people were not shown enough evidence to support the choices made by the characters to join in her and be on her side and be the mob with yeah. her.
And it's just,
it doesn't,
to be fair, most of the mob are characters we never meet.
I know.
So we can't actually know
and
that they're
not.
That's
very clever.
I actually also, if I had a criticism of this movie and the script itself, which goes with what Jamie's saying, is I don't think Frank Darabont or the movie is on the side of small town people. AKA hillbillies, hicks, whatever you want
Oddly
to call them.
Oddly enough, yeah.
I think he's got
a good point.
At the time, he viewed that type of person
as causing
the problems in the world.
Yeah.
This movie, he's saying that you're all idiots and you would follow her. You
That's
small town people.
Yeah, one of the chapters.
Even though Andre Bauer is treated badly, and he's not a yeah. small town person.
He's a smart person.
He's a smart person, but I feel like the movie's against small towners.
So one of the chapters.
Right.
So we don't need to go into the sequence approach, but this one has a great it uses the
you
sequence.
You mean Blu-ray chapters?
Or Blu-ray
DVD chapters?
No,
in the script.
In the
yes.
script
okay.
that's out there,
yeah.
it's every single sequence fades to black and superimposed on the screen
is the Kevin Smith model.
Is a
Frasier
title.
Model.
yeah, exactly
the
like
Frasier
that.
Model.
And each one of the sequences has a title that comes on that was supposed to come on screen as scripted, and I'm glad they didn't do it.
Right, right.
And one of the chapter names is the Flat Earther Society.
Right, right.
Very placing judgment.
Man.
Yeah.
It makes the movie more relevant.
yeah, now, no, right? it's yeah. still, yeah. The chapter, I mean, it's a great instruction. Like, one way to, we just talked about this in the Good Boys episode, but one easy way to kind of knock out the feature is to knock them out in like 10 to 12 page pieces of the script at a time. And like, this is something that I do. I give my sequence a name. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this own mini movie is called this. And that's exactly what this script does. It gives each section of the script a name.
Is these script names are going with the whole, he had a definite
Absolutely.
Bias and agenda.
Right. Yes. Yeah. They support what you're saying right now.
And if I could add to this whole discussion too, with what Jamie's saying is, you know what my least favorite part of this whole movie is? It's the pharmacy scene. I don't really care for that whole segment. And you know why? Because that's the one that's a monster movie.
Yeah, there's no human.
Good there's point. No. It, that's the movie that I think a lot of people wanted.
Yeah.
And I don't care at all. I mean, like, yeah, spiders are gross and everything.
It's at the fun and game, that portion of the story I often called Fun and Games Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the back end, and it's like another set of fun and games, premise delivery.
Well, it doesn't really do much.
You could almost edit it out.
Yeah, you could edit it out.
Yeah, they get the drugs.
It serves, if anything, to make the characters more scared, tangibly to touch the evil.
Yeah, this is what you're going to face once
it
you try to get out.
It does serve, like, a character purpose. It's just, it's that actual scene is the monster movie part of this whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's like, man, I don't care about
it. It's the least compelling.
It's not compelling at all. Right, yeah. I mean, it's fine.
It's great, gross out moments.
It's a great it's a great monster scene.
The guy
says,
"It's our fault."
But it's a distraction.
I can feel them.
Right. Yeah. It's a distraction from the movie I want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That I've already grown to want. You know?
Yeah.
Whenever I watch this movie, and I think it probably already is, I should Google it, but I think it would make a great play.
Yeah.
And I'd love, if it wasn't,
that'd
be
amazing.
I'd probably write the play without the bugs and it'd just be the people and the yelling and the factions and that kind of stuff.
You can have mist.
Flat earther society. Yeah.
The guy who gets sucked out, he just gets sucked out into the mist. You don't see a tentacle or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, something. Yeah, I don't know, whatever it was.
Right.
You know, but I just keep everything off screen and, you know, keep us in the.
Oh, that rope scene. So good.
I think there needs to be more horror. Theatrical experience. There are a lot. They've done The Exorcist and stuff.
We just don't get to see it much around here.
The
where
Blair
we
Witch,
are.
The play.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if anyone can do that, Jamie.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
But yeah. Let's talk about
the moral premise.
Yeah,
do you want to go there now, Jamie?
That's why I was looking at the thing.
We've jumped around a lot.
We have jumped because this movie is so divisive.
Yeah. I mean, are we ready to talk about nihilism, Jamie?
I think so. I mean, we might have, that's the big thing in here.
Well, why is that such a topic for us on this one?
So a lot of times when I come to this theme, I like to do this thing called the moral premise. And it's debatable whether theme is the same thing as the moral premise. Because I think the moral premise almost more relates to character arcs.
Yes.
Whereas theme, like what he said, the monsters are inside. That's not really
character. It's like more of an idea.
Arc. Yeah, that's like the bigger picture that encompasses like the individual character arc or the change or the journey in some ways with the moral premise. The moral premise is a book by this guy, Stanley Williams. If you ever see that crazy diagram, the diamond that everybody's making fun of lately, that's his. I will say, I always apologize.
The story vagina.
Yeah.
Story
vagina. I always apologize for him because really what he was doing there wasn't saying screenwriting is this complicated. He was really saying it's this simple by saying they're all the same. And people kind of say, oh, you have to understand all these things to know how to do it.
Yeah.
And really he was saying, pick one.
The message was misconstrued.
The message. Yeah, it's more
visually, it did look kind of like a mess.
Yeah.
But I get why people were like critical of it, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah. He was more saying pick one. Here's all of them combined. Anyway.
And they all do the same thing.
They all do the same thing. That's what he was saying. But it's still funny. So he has a book called The Moral Premise. The Moral Premise, it basically turns the premise of the film, the theme, the character arc, kind of all this stuff it gets wrapped around into vice leads to bad result. Virtue leads to good results. You can state kind of the premise of your movie in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular movie, I struggle with what it is.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure what leads to good result.
What is the virtue of treating your neighbor equally, the golden rule?
I think if there were a way to get to it, I think the key might not be the lead players. I think it actually has to do with the woman who leaves at the very beginning to find her kids.
Yeah, I agree.
Like if you're gonna find it, she's some kind of fulcrum there.
That's the one I was narrowing down on. So she followed. I'm just gonna riff.
They all
know.
Sin by not helping her.
Exactly. Yes. It's
she was actually there.
Help
sin.
Treat your neighbor as you would treat yourself. So if she needs help, then you help her. So what is that vice virtue argument?
And strangely, she was the one that had hope or latched onto some hope or something.
She did. She believed
based on heroic virtue.
Yeah.
But is that any better than religion in some ways?
Yeah,
I don't know. I've wrestled.
I mean, I go back to there's so many. I didn't write what was said. But
the movie just like she made it just because she
luck.
Happened to make it was fucking
luck.
Dumb luck.
Should I frame nihilism super quick first?
Yeah. What is actual nihilism?
Well,
not Twitter nihilism.
Nihilism is kind of like the the kind of meaningless of the universe. Like there's meaningless to life, and there's no rhyme or reason to the way things happen is kind of the basis of nihilism in general.
It doesn't mean you're evil.
It doesn't mean you're evil.
I would add on to that, like as far as when we're talking about cinematic experiences, a character can achieve their goal or not achieve their goal, and they're still going to suffer in the end, no matter what, because we are born to suffer. And nothing matters.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you do. Suffer.
But a nihilist.
But you could still.
A nihilist can still not call. You can be a nihilist and still your actions aren't dictated by nihilism. Does that make sense?
Right. Yes. Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
I just want to make sure. Like, I don't think people understand. They think of the Big Lebowski.
And now that's why I'm laughing.
You know,
you're
right.
Head.
Right.
They think, we think we're nihilists. We love nothing.
We love nothing. Right. Which is great. But I like, you know, some people can believe in nihilism and still do what is a seemingly good in the world.
Yeah.
Because they know it's just all, they can just try.
And strangely, a movie like the Serbian film could be.
Has anyone besides me at this table seen
not,
a Serbian
I
film?
Not.
I have not.
But just saying.
You guys would not enjoy it.
Like the most dark in whatever movie could actually have a positive theme to it. I'm not saying that one does. Whereas a romantic comedy could be nihilistic based on whatever happened. I can't think of one.
Yeah, they could get the girl or get the guy.
Like,
they do everything right,
get the girl.
You guys have seen Wet Hot American Summer, right?
Yes.
I think the end joke of Wet Hot American Summer is the nihilism of the fact that she's like, hey, you're really great. You're a good person, but Andy's really hot. I'm gonna fuck him. Bye. You know what I mean? Like if that kind of was playing with that nihilism of like,
I gotcha.
Yeah, like yeah. It doesn't matter actually. Nothing mattered that you watch.
So this Stanley Williams moral premise guy, he reframes this whole argument into, he calls it either false or inconsistent moral premises. And he's kind of a Christian bent, so he'd definitely fall in the flat earther community. But he's a he kind of has a positive outlook towards film, and he thinks film is the way we want the world to be, not necessarily the way it is. But he believes
I don't like that.
He thinks
I don't like putting limits on it.
Yeah, well, no, he doesn't say that's the only way it could be.
I know.
He just thinks that most people go to the movies for that reason.
Yes, I would agree.
Having said what I said about when I saw it, I agree.
Yeah,
people hated this movie in the theater.
I kind of phrased him wrong. He said people go to the movies to see the way they want the world, not necessarily
the way
it
is.
Necessarily. There are other types of people that do go.
That's like
the
very core of premise delivery. They want to see that premise delivered as though it cannot be in their own lives.
Yes.
So he argues that no movie that has a false premise or an inconsistent premise has ever been big at the box office. And that's arbitrary, obviously. And The Mist would kind of fall in that territory where it wasn't a super big hit.
Yeah.
It actually did better than most of the ones he points out. And the ones he listed that I was kind of joking. And you could go
You
could go on his site and check them out. Because he actually goes into the reasons why they have false or inconsistent moral premises.
Right, right.
So, and I'm not going to go through all those. But the ones he listed, they're kind of old. Ishtar, City Slickers 2. That was the one I thought of with you.
I don't think that's why that did, Ben.
My favorite one. Burt Wonderstone. exactly.
What a weird.
I actually liked
Burt Wonderstone too.
It was fun. I'm a magician guy, so I like it.
Yeah.
He has the Hurt Locker, 7 Pounds. Narnia, Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
I couldn't even tell you what happened in that movie, and I saw it.
And that's why it's not really worth going through them. But he actually breaks down why they have false premises for each of these. So if you've seen one of these movies, it might be useful. Just kind of check out the moral premise blog spot. I wish he had bigger movies, but the problem is, his argument is, there aren't movies that are huge or popular.
I don't want to talk about this much, but what is the false premise of City Slickers 2?
Because
they do find the gold in the end and they become better people, just like a normal comedy from the 90s. You know what I mean? Like, what?
I don't remember the movie, but I'll give it a quick skinny. He says that, and this is why it's the world the way it ought to be, but he says not pursuing illicit wealth leads to sadness. But obtaining illicit wealth leads to happiness. He says somehow that violates things.
Back to the Future does that.
You'd have to read it. Well, maybe
literally Back to the Future does that.
I can't argue.
That's why Chris McGovern hates Back to the Future. Back to the Future has a false premise, according to him.
So you might, but
I'm just saying,
is that why he wouldn't do it?
No, I think it was likeness rights or something like that. But when he hated the fact that Marty's family got the reward for everything Marty did was wealth. That's what he hates about that movie. He gets the car and the girl.
Yes.
And that's in the 80s. That's what
it's good. A good
that's what a good life is wealth.
That's a good.
It's
call.
Like, that's a bad lesson. Message. I'm not agreeing completely, but that what I'm saying is what he's laying down is.
No,
that,
you're talking about Back to the Future 1.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that another day, but I think there's other themes.
I was
play.
Just saying for his rules here, it seems like he's.
There, I think there's the other, there's other themes that play in Back to the Future. I can't remember City Slickers 2. I mean, he could be right for all I know.
I've probably seen it more than you ever would. And I can't really remember it either. So.
But that's the thing. This whole thing is better tackled with, hey, I have a movie, Back to the Future, that has that premise.
Right, right, right.
Debate me. Fight me.
So then, if we tackle the mist with this.
Yeah, yeah. So the mist, I'm not sure what kind of message. Like, in a typical movie like this, it would be something like, let's say they survived in the end. So it'd be, I don't know, you could come up with a theme where...
Like, keep hope alive.
Yeah, keep hope alive. If you don't fall into fear... And be overcome by false, you know, if you follow the truth instead of fall into fear, you live.
Right, right.
Whereas if you fall into these false gods, then you die. But that's not what he did.
No.
So that's where it gets confusing. And that's why it seems more like the world the way it really is and less like the way it ought to be.
Yeah,
and that's
I agree.
Kind of what this takes
which place. I think goes with the rest of the movie, right? Like what you were saying, how it's the point of view of the author, not the characters.
Yeah.
The, right,
the
I mean,
writer's choice, not
so
the character's choice.
We're talking about the ending, pretty much, right now, right? I mean,
yeah. What do you? So, Jamie, based on everything, do you think that this is a nihilistic movie?
I think it is a movie that says no matter what you do in the world, that the bad end will still come for you.
I have a great example that is better than all of his.
Okay,
which is Terminator 3.
Okay.
I know it's not a beloved movie or anything, and it didn't...
Kristen Loki or whatever her name. She's
but awesome. The ending of Terminator 3, much even more so than 2, was that everything they did didn't matter. Judgment Day was still going to happen. Right?
Yeah.
And so what... Like, you know what I'm saying? By what you're saying to me is, what do I take from that?
Right.
It's the same thing I would take from The Mist. Like, it was inevitable.
Yes.
Yeah.
This whole time.
Like,
so...
The last line of... Well, there's two things that like, I want to... Just, I don't know what I want to say about them, but like, for instance,
I love that you don't know what you want to say. That's great.
Okay, so they added. It's not in the script. The last line of the movie is, "They're dead, for what?" And they added that in the moment to kind of put an exclamation point on the, you know, what they're trying to say. But I don't know what they're trying to say. And
whose line is that?
David, after he sees all the soldiers and the mist is clear, he's screaming and
yelling.
He's yelling. Yeah. He says, "They're dead. And for what?
They blew it up."
He just says, like, the last...
You bastard.
You bastard.
The last line of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's not in the script. In the script, it just says, "He's suffering and he'll always suffer."
Right.
Forever. That's the last line of the script.
Right.
So, I mean, there you go. I think this is, like, as nihilistic as it gets.
Yeah. Well, he can never escape the mist now.
Yeah.
The mist will always envelop Tom Jane.
Yeah. But we didn't really talk about the difference between
a nihilistic
ending and a downer ending, and I think this is
I think
both.
I got a really important point here.
Very good point.
That is a good point. Frank Darabont also views this movie as a Twilight Zone episode.
Which says
a lot about, because Twilight Zone episodes are nihilistic.
Yes.
Like Burgess Meredith breaking his glasses at the end.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's just like, right. It's just like, now he's forever stuck.
I laugh at it, but it's just so
great. Well, I laugh at the end of The Mist a little bit. It's kind of funny, like in a really sick way.
I don't laugh.
It's a twisted capper.
It's incredibly sad, but when he sees it, he's like, "What the?"
Here's the difference with the Twilight Zone, and it gets to your point.
Yeah.
So a downer ending is much different. So you could have this ending, But if he didn't learn some lesson in the middle, it's a tragedy. But we walk out saying the world makes sense because he didn't learn the lesson.
Yeah,
he should have held on to hope and known he would have, you know, lived, but he didn't. He fell to fear in the end, and he shot. And that's kind of the way I view it.
Yeah.
When I see what's her name, Melissa McBride, is that her name?
The Walking Dead woman.
The Walking Dead woman.
Yeah.
Drive by with the kid. But she's awesome in this. Yeah. But she drives by with the kid.
So that's an interesting point too. Is she was kept. She was supposed to actually never come back.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But her performance was so good.
She was so good.
That they found that they wanted to bring her back again.
Yeah.
So you could argue that he should have somehow kept hope alive. And actually, my problem with the end, and I don't mind. I'm somebody that doesn't mind these kind of endings. Yeah. But again,
I love it.
It's yeah. not like
oh, so do I.
It's not like saying these endings are wrong. The argument he makes is just people don't necessarily go, so the box office will be smaller.
No, agree.
That's his argument.
I fully agree.
We're
there,
not trying to argue that this ending is wrong. You can have a movie that says the world is meaningless. That's fine. Go for it.
You can have. That's the point of telling art. It's like art. Say something. It's meaningless.
There is a part of me that says, well, she held on to hope and she lived. He did not and then died. And my only argument with that, though, is the end. It felt a little rushed. Like, we're out of gas. Let's kill everybody.
Well,
that was the only problem I had at the end.
The problem is that the end is a montage.
Yeah.
It's a montage.
And it doesn't feel like it.
It doesn't feel like it. But if
emotionally.
I've seen him talk about this. He's like, they were actually driving around for like 2 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't just, but you can't.
It feels like 2 hours.
Yeah. It's not 2 hours. It's like a long time.
Yeah.
Like, and then the run's out of gas. And then they.
It's, yeah.
Number one, also remember, you can't see anything. So you have no car. You're in the middle of God knows where.
Yeah.
If you think about it in context, I understand where it ends, but I can see how people were like, what are they just, do they just drive away? And they're like, oh, well,
yeah,
it's over.
But it's like they make all this effort to drive away and then they just run out of gas and they kill each other. That's kind of what it feels like in the execution of it.
So,
but yeah, I can understand.
What I was going to say is that the difference you were talking about from nihilism to being just a downer ending,
mm-hmm.
I think the reason you can tell this is a script by a very angry man is that you could actually adjust this so there was one more bullet in the gun easily.
Mm-hmm.
Toby Jones could have just shot Miss Carmody in the head, not the gun.
Yeah.
And then in the end, Tom Jane could have actually executed himself in that car. And as the audience, we just see, I'm not trying to rewrite the miss. I'm just saying if that happened and Tom Jane was dead and then we see the tanks come through.
Yeah.
That's a downer ending, but I don't think it's a nihilistic
it's
one.
Not. Yeah.
You that's understand right. what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, keeping him alive is an intentionally
absolutely and that's
nihilistic
where,
thing.
That's where the
that's
lesson
what we're talking, yeah, right.
He didn't exactly.
It would be
like,
easy to have Tom Jane have another bullet and kill himself,
right?
Because like,
but
he fails. His goal is for them to escape the Misk without getting killed by the monsters, but he ends up being the monster, you know, killing everyone. And then he still is doomed to suffer forever. So I think it's both a downer and a nihilistic. It's like, it hits you both sides. Woo.
You can look at it just as like, hey, have some patience.
Look how somber I am talking about it.
Have some patience should be the theme. Have some patience.
Yeah.
That's
wait around. If everyone just waited like another day, even the crazy people.
Everyone would have.
Everything would be fine.
Right.
Like, just wait. Like, you're in, like, that's what I think is amazing about this movie is that I don't know if he intended this, but the fact that it's a supermarket is what makes it beautiful. It's because they had the supplies to live to the point way farther than they had to. They had the food.
Yeah. They could live for a very long time.
They could have survived that one attack
through
the window and lived through this whole thing.
And that's a credit to Stephen King more than
that's
Frank
what I'm
going to
give
Stephen
King. But that's what's great about it is that they didn't. It's that like they're panicking and it's like you could panic a little less. You've got all these supplies.
Yeah.
You got bathrooms. Like it's not it's bad, but like you could be stuck somewhere else.
If you can barricade those doors.
You could not go insane. You'll be okay.
You could almost see another movie where then when they get outside, they realize, oh, it's just a power failure. You know, and they all went crazy and killed each other.
Oh, man.
You
know, that's great.
That's also a nihilistic ending, kind of, though.
It is.
Yeah,
they did.
It kind of shows, Again, it all depends on what lesson is meant. Like, if there is a way out for survival, then the nihilism goes away. If you demonstrate a way out for survival that they should have taken and said, if they took this, they would have been okay.
I think it does that, though.
Does it? How is it?
Well, I think, I mean, what I just said.
If he had just waited.
If they I think, okay, the positive, the non-nihilistic nature of this movie is not in the movie itself. What it is that if the situation ever happened to you.
Yeah, yeah.
You would all be like, hey, let's not mess this up.
Oh, yeah.
Let's not get all misty, okay? Like, you'd be like, no, I'm serious. Like, that, wouldn't this movie come to your mind if a similar situation totally. Happened?
Well,
yeah.
But the flip side of that, while that's true,
it's a weird point, but yeah.
But the hero didn't have a choice in that. He probably would have done that had everybody not gone crazy.
It's more of a lesson for the other characters. Yeah.
That's
not
what I'm
him.
Saying. Like, what's his path to survival? Like, what could he have done to survive?
Let me revise what I just said. Mm-hmm. You could say that to the Miss Carmody in the grocery store. You could be like,
right.
You sound a lot like the villain in The Mist. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. yeah, like it's a lesson for them.
Right, right.
Not for the Tom Janes. And we're the Tom Janes. Mm-hmm. I think he wants the audience to be the Tom Janes. Yeah. The people who like The Mist are the Tom Janes.
Yeah.
Right? Does that make sense? I'm trying to defend it in a weird way here.
Well, it's like our hero had a chance to survive. Usually the way things work is our hero, through their actions, learn something, figure out a way that gives them a positive result in the end. In this case, the people that did the best things still die in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they make a horrible decision in the end.
Yeah.
That... Again, it's a little... anyway, that's really the bulk of it.
Let me ask you this, because it's something that I really don't think about. What is Tom Jane's arc?
I don't think they're... it's a negative trajectory.
It is.
That's part of the reason why it is what we're saying.
What is don't shoot your kid? Like, what's the arc? Yeah.
I'll protect you. He's willing to protect his father.
He would have done that from moment one.
He would have, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most tragedies are they get a position to change. But I don't think he was a bad person. He was good from the beginning.
Yeah.
Who changed during the movie? During the script, who changes?
Only negatives change. There's only negative changes, which is like Bill Sadler's character goes from... on the side of the logical people and changes into joining the mob.
You could maybe argue that it's depending on how you view like the world, I guess. You could argue that Toby Jones has like a heroic change.
He does. He goes from being kind of wimpy guy to guy who saves the
rises
day.
To the occasion.
Becomes a badass.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yes. And he's that's nihilistic. He gets torn up.
Right away.
Big deal. You rose to the occasion and were saving people's lives.
That really goes to the whole Miss Carmody was right theory. It's like he takes her out and then get torn up.
Yeah.
But
character arcs aren't really a part of this movie.
No, not at all.
And it's intentional.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, that guy knows how to write characters, so.
Like, we know Frank Darabont knows what he's.
Yeah.
I think that's why I like it so much is, like, I love intention, even if it's, like, a focused bullet that is so obvious. You know what I mean? Like, that's what this is. This is a focused atom bomb of commentary.
I find short stories often have, like, no character arcs at all.
Right.
You know, they're just quick.
So that's fitting.
This being a novella, you know, it kind of feels like that.
Short films often are low.
It's not important to the resonance.
Yeah.
It's all plot and theme and not character.
It's very thematic.
But yet the characters aren't, like, bad.
Yeah.
They're just already defined when we get there.
Yeah.
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 But
it doesn't
have the half man.
If there was some lesson to be learned that he learned somewhere, like don't give up hope, let's say that was evident at the 50 page mark.
Oh, you mean Tom Jane?
Tom Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he got to the end and he did give up hope because he just couldn't see any other way out. And then he killed them. That would be just a down ending because we would walk out of the movie and say, oh, I get it. If we keep hope, we will not end up in a bad way like he did. So that's the way you make it an uplifting movie, because he becomes a tragic character.
It's a movie that puts all the work on us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, like what we're doing right now on this podcast is all the work is on us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The movie's not giving us anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a part of me that, again, the Stephen King novel, we haven't talked about this, the novella, didn't end this way. The novella just ended with them driving off into the mist with some semblance of hope.
He just sort of dreamed that this was a possibility.
He thought about, well, I have the bullets. If it comes to that, I can do it. But, you know, there was hope. So we're driving off into hope. And there's part of me that just thinks he put this on because he likes the Twilight Zone. And he says, you know, it would be badass. You know, so there might not be a huge intent with it.
And it's
he
just worth noting that Stephen ending. King prefers this ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's not ambiguous. I mean, they're ambiguous film endings in a big budget movie
I certainly don't think the movie would be better of them just driving
out
in the mist.
No way.
Or like just a they just stop and their gas is out. And it just pans away from the car and then directed by Frank Darabont. I'm like, what? Okay.
I almost think you'd have to do a more of a war inside the grocery store. Like you'd have to make that sort of final. Like they somehow punish the sinners in the
like they light it on fire.
Exactly. There would have to be some war basically that happens. Some face off.
One thing I always find interesting about the ending, not with Tom Jane, but the when they're getting away, you know, the manager of the supermarket who is in the Tom Jane group, and then he splits away when all the stuff happens and he runs to the door. They let him back
in. They let him back in.
Which I always thought was really interesting because like Miss Carmody's dead. And everyone, it's like as soon as she was dead, the spell was broken.
Mm-hmm.
And they like, you know what I mean? Because they were trying to kill. He was mincemeat before them in their eyes.
Yeah.
And now they're all like, they learned. They
fast.
Changed.
Yeah.
They changed. They learned something. Like they realized their sin.
Yeah.
And changed really quick.
Yeah.
It's
a great moment.
It's a
I
small
remember that.
Thing.
I remember being like, what?
Like,
oh,
why?
Because
you're like, before that, they would never have let him back in.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but
because the soldier tries to get back in, and they say
they
don't let him.
But she's gone, and they realize the spell. You know what happened here?
Yeah.
Oh no, we killed someone.
Yeah,
we're responsible. So in a weird way, they have more of an arc as a group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the people in the car sort of have like, in the end, a truck almost like a mob mentality. Like let's just kill. Like it's a Jim Jones, and it's interesting that they call her earlier, like, she's going to become our very own Jim Jones, and then they end up taking the Jim Jones action.
The movie's all about microcosms, right?
Mm.
Microcosm of society all the way through, and then in that car, you're another microcosm of another society.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Mm. It is. It's just, it's not traditional in any way, really.
Yeah. I love it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want every movie to be a cheeseburger. this ain't a cheeseburger.
No way.
The thing I wrestle about with the ending is his actions in the end heroic? He's punished for it, but it kind of takes courage. They all look at each other. They all nod. They're going out
the
together.
The decision
their
isn't
way.
Made easily.
Yeah.
There's...
It's kind of a weird thing, but then he gets punished for doing, in that case, maybe the courageous thing. Like, I'm going
to
take away everybody's suffering. You know, I don't know.
He does suffer for just his son alone.
He makes the sacrifice in some way.
He's
right.
making
like,
the
he
sacrifice.
He's
son.
The one that has to, the son
yeah.
is going to just die. He has to live with it so that the son may not suffer.
He makes a rational choice, and he's the guy who's going to take the
it's almost like
pain.
A commentary against rationality. Like the logical thing for us all to do is to commit suicide. Right?
Or join a weird religious cult.
Right.
But on the flip side, I don't think that's what he believes. Frank
Darabont?
No.
At all.
No.
Maybe he believes the suicide part.
But.
Like, I mean, I'm not saying that in particular, but maybe some allegorical.
Right.
Yeah.
Like,
I think in the end, I don't want to be like a school teacher on this, but in the end, what we're doing right now is the reason it exists.
Could be.
Because it's just, I don't even know if he could give us the answers. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's the point of the ending. Like, what does it mean?
Yeah,
he could be like, I don't know, you figure it out.
Yeah, and much like City Slickers too. No, I didn't.
When Billy Crystal executes John Lovitz to stop him from
much Curly's like
rat.
The end of Bert Wonderstead.
What a weird. But I mean, okay, this movie didn't flop though.
It didn't flop. It's kind of more like. His theory is more like you can't point to any huge blockbusters that have these kind of endings. And that's fine. I mean, it's fine. Yeah. It's fine to do a solid single. Just like you said, he spent $18 million because he wanted the ending.
Yep.
That's fine. That's fine. It's not all about money. Sometimes it's about making a good movie.
It's a movie about how different factions of this society react to actual information.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my view of this movie is. Because the whole movie is a repetitive thing of, here's the information presented, and how are you going to process it?
There's more debates in this movie, I think, than I mean, there's like 7 or 8 major 3-4 minute long debates about what's happening, what are we going to do next, like you said, based on the information.
And Toby Jones is this odd little side character who has the arc, and he's also fully aware of how society reacts to itself. He's like the philosopher. Like, you put people in a room together and they'll try to kill each other.
Yeah, there's that great moment. Yeah, right. It's one of those outsiders versus local.
That's more nihilistic than anything.
The moment where the manager is trying to take power.
Yeah.
And Toby is like, that's great. You shut the fuck up. And then you can keep writing our names down and filling out the report.
Now I think about it. His little line there, his little line about society, that's kind of the nihilism theme right there, right? He's like, you put people in a room and they kill each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of him stating theme, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We always talk about the statement of theme.
Yeah.
And he's like,
there's a ton of those. All of those debates include those arguments about that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the whole movie just has a constant, here's characters presented with information. What do they do? What do they do? What do they do? You know? And who are you?
Get scared.
Who are you? Who are you? That's what it's. It's not, I don't know, it's not traditional in any way.
No. Awesome.
You know.
And I think horror movies especially are things that can do this better than some other things. Because sometimes they just leave you with a jaded feeling and you walk out, you know,
like City Slickers 2.
like City Slickers 2. I got to go back and watch City Slickers 2.
Yeah, maybe it's fucking like hardcore nihilistic.
That's just what I learned.
Next week on Raiders Podcast. City Slickers 2. We break down City Slickers too. 4 listens.
I mean, whatever. You know, I'm game. But is there anything else we really want to?
I think we really dove deep into this one.
This is a hard one.
Yeah, it's a hard one because it's not a cheeseburger.
Yeah. I feel like Misery or Stand By Me would be easy.
Yeah, I'm glad we did this one, though.
Those are all great movies. I'm just.
Yeah.
This one's the hardest. I think Creepshow's an anthology.
Lawnmower Man.
Ah.
Jamie, you know, I would. I love
Me
Lawnmower
too.
Man.
that's the next one on his list, right after Ishtar.
Ishtar.
Oh, my God.
The nihilism of Lawnmower Man.
What'd you guys learn?
You go first.
I learned that Frank Darabont wrote The Fly 2. I didn't even realize.
Yeah, he did.
I didn't realize.
I think... What did I learn about this movie is that if I'm totally willing to whore myself out to an agenda I agree with. But I knew that already, I guess. I mean, I agree with every criticism that you guys have made about that. And that's what I like about the movie. That's why I like it. Specifically.
Yeah.
You know, because it's for me.
Yeah.
It's an auteur movie that's literally for me. Nihilism, not so much.
Yeah.
But I also like something that's willing to say, like, something that I don't want to hear.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
You know, I want him to, like, you know, take the gun out and go jump, you know, do it like a Legolas and jump on that thing, walking thing and shoot.
Bam!
It. Right. Yeah. I want that to happen, but it's not going to. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I learned, and it was mainly by listening to that commentary, when he pointed out the importance of the promise scene, promise me that you won't let the monsters get me, that he moved it, that he was really, it was talking about both the people, it could be the people inside or the monsters, you know, that's what the kid was saying, don't let them get me. And that the ending, he saw his dad as a monster in the end the moment before he died. So that's what I learned.
I think there's something instructive to be say about adapting something in that he figured out the ending, the new ending, through the text. He found a little line of text and he expanded that into a scene and made the ending. And I think if you're when you're adapting, that's an awesome thing to learn. There are things in the text that aren't necessarily the story, but maybe they could be expanded out or twisted or something. So the clues are often in the text when you're doing that adapting. So if you do a Dollar Baby and you only show it at two festivals, that maybe that'll help you.
I've got one thing I want to say I also learned. Yeah. Is that if there's one thing about this movie that I think I learned on this rewatch, it's the absolute and utter frustration it causes with people being unable to properly explain anything with detail. Like, it angered me. I haven't watched it in like 2 years. This time it angered me so much. Like, dude, can you just say tentacles? Like, why is no one, why are like, there's something in the mist. I'm like, you saw tentacles. Say it.
Yeah.
Stop. I just angered me. Like, they weren't saying it.
That can be a, I'm not sure that I noticed this, but that could be a writing problem too. Like,
it might be.
Lost did that a lot and it annoyed me.
I never watched Lost.
Like, it was like, if everybody would just sit down and have a conversation, they could figure some stuff out. But instead, they're all doing something
like,
in the mist.
For a movie that's like, this is what real life is. Yeah. I'm like, in real life, somebody go, there's tentacles coming out of that door.
Yeah.
Somebody would have said that.
Right.
They wouldn't be like, there's something in the mist. They would have been like, no, dude, there's like tentacles coming through the door. It grabbed a kid. What are we going to do? Yeah.
I see that. I'm actually writing a script right now where I started to do that. And I notice I'm doing it. And I'm like, but I need to do it because I need to. I can't just have people say tentacles. Like, I need the tentacles on page 10, but then I can't have everybody talking about tentacles on page 30.
But the truth is like that what we would do in real life, right? Like, for a movie that's trying to say that, it's annoying that they are just so like meandering about what
it's implausible.
They literally see like bugs and stuff, and they still talk about what's in the mist. I'm like, it's bugs.
That's once again the writer's choice, not the character's choice. Right. But he's a master, and it works.
I'm just saying the frustration of that. Got to me. I was like, oh, why is everyone just dancing around the specific verbiage?
It's really a common writing problem.
Absolutely. I see it all the time.
Right. Yeah. That just it frustrated me really bad.
And it's the hands of the writer overweighing what would happen in reality or the truth of the moment.
And I get it. That adds to like the monster movie creepy aspect and everything. I get it, but come on. I mean, you saw the characters saw the tentacles. Just say it. Don't be like, there's something weird that just happened back there. Don't say that. Tentacles. They ripped the Shermanator apart, man. All right. I think that's everything.
It's good.
Right?
That's
everybody
everything.
Good?
Yeah. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you, guys. And thank you, everyone who voted.
Yeah. Hope you enjoyed. Hope you were glad we chose this. We chose this based on your poll.
Right.
Yeah, send us your comments and your own opinions.
And we'll probably do another poll in the future.
Yeah,
right.
Definitely.
I think that was a very successful thing.
I definitely think we should.
We'll do that in the future. Which City Slickers movie we should
tackle?
One or two?
Two or upcoming three. All right.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbuster, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy, available only on Thundergrunt.